From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview. I promise some new interviews. We've got some coming. A new interview with former Vermont Governor Madeline May Cunin about her memoir, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s, published by Greenwriters Press, and due out tomorrow. Governor Cunin has written three previous books, Living a Political Life, The New Feminist Agenda, Defining the Next Revolution for Women, Work, and Family, and Pearls, Politics, and Power. She is currently James Marsh Professor at Large at the University of Vermont, where she gives guest lectures on feminism and women and politics. She also serves on the board of the Institute for Sustainable Communities, ISC, a non-governmental organization that she founded in 1991, and she recently launched Emerge Vermont to encourage and support women in politics. She lives in Shelburne, Vermont. Here's a little information about the book. Many readers are already familiar with Madeline Cunin, the former three-term governor of Vermont who served as the deputy secretary of education and ambassador to Switzerland under President Bill Clinton. In her newest book, a memoir entitled Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s, the topic is aging, but she looks well beyond the physical tolls and explores the emotional ones as well. And she has had an extraordinary life, governor, ambassador, feminist, wife, mother, professor, poet, and much, much more. As recently reported in the New York Times, a girl born today can expect to live to the age of 90, on average. Boys, on the other hand, can expect to live until 85. Life expectancy for many is increasing, yet people rarely contemplate the emotional changes that come alongside the physical changes of aging. Madeline May Cunin wants to change that. Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s takes a close and incisive look at what it is like to grow old. The book is a memoir, yet most important of all, it is an honest and positive look at aging and how it has affected her life. When I spoke with Governor Cunin, I asked her to begin by reading from her new memoir, Coming of Age. The short piece we chose is titled No Longer. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
No longer. No longer will we make love before breakfast. No longer will I dream of seeing New Zealand or the Cape of Good Hope or bears in the wild. No longer will I say yes more than no. No longer will danger sparkle and safety look dull. No longer will I look at my body without comparison between who I was and who I have become, blaming the light for the difference. No longer can I toss my hair over my face and count 100 strokes. No longer can I do without night cream and day cream, slathering on ounce after ounce. No longer will I be comfortable sitting in my chair reading for hours without getting up to stretch my arms and legs. No longer can I walk without looking down at my feet to avoid mean cracks and malicious bumps. No longer can I skip down the stairs like a girl, flying without feeling a thing. No longer can I approach the precipice without swaying against my will. No longer do I think ahead of where I will be in 10 years or 20 or more. Now I think in ones or twos or threes, long enough to still hunger for the food of life. No longer do I wish for the next day or the next year to come quickly, like I did the year I turned 10. I want the days to saunter like a leisurely museum stroller who stops now and then to gaze and get closer to the canvas, to see the brush strokes, and then steps back for the long view before moving on.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I love that. It's wonderful. Have you always written poetry?
Off and on, but not always, no.
No, okay. Well, it's wonderful to read your poetry, and I'm not going to specifically talk about the poem you just read, but I love it, and a lot of your poetry is very, I mean, it's very artful, It's not always completely on the nose. I love the word play and the syllabic play. It's really fun. Yeah, I forgot.
Thank you.
You know, I forgot before I read the book that you were a writer before you were in politics.
Right.
Yeah, and right. I was starting to read the book and I was blown away. I thought, oh my goodness, this is so wonderful. And then I remembered, as you got to the point about the Free Press, that you were a reporter at the Free Press before.
Right, that was a long time ago.
Yeah. So you begin the book with an epigraph by Anne Sexton. In a dream, you are never 80. I love that. It's wonderful. That was perfect. Were you excited when you ran across that?
Yes. Well, I felt it was so true.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. This book, to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but as I read this book, I felt it had a certain vulnerability to it that your previous books have not had, but it also had this caution thrown to the wind, and I had a sense of almost a relief in being able to be vulnerable on the page. Do you think that's true?
Well, something happened to me at some point as I got older where I felt I could take the risk of being vulnerable, of being personal, of letting my thoughts develop without thinking about what are people going to think. It's like I opened a door into a different space, and I just let it go. Of course, I censored a few things, but not very much. And the upshot is now I'm a little anxious. You know, have I been too self-revealing? But it led to a different kind of writing. I mean, I've written other books about politics, and, you know, they were normal prose. And in this, I just went into different places and probably became a slightly different person.
Right. Well, I feel like when you have written about politics, you're writing about subjects that are of interest to us all, but they do not necessarily touch each of our lives in the same way that a book like this does. Mm-hmm. And I think being very personal and honest and open-hearted in writing this, it made me feel very engaged as a reader and feel like I knew the narrator, you know?
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, a lot of books have been written about aging, and they're mostly about how to stay young, how not to age. And here I deal with aging to the best of my ability and just try to write about things that change in my life and are changing as I get older.
But you were also very honest about the things that are hard about aging, the things that you're reluctant to, you know, let happen, you know.
Yeah. Well, your body changes.
Yeah.
And your mind to some extent as well.
And your hair, you said.
Yes.
Let's see. Oh, okay. So this is a nothing little thing, but it made me wonder, where is your favorite sycamore? You said that you feel like it's appropriate that you live in an area called Sycamore because you have a favorite sycamore.
Well, it's not in Sycamore. It's on the road to...
Is it in Shelburne?
It's in Shelburne.
Is it at the bottom of Irish Hill?
Yes.
You cross the water. And then there's a little house with a huge sycamore.
Yes, that's it.
That's my favorite sycamore.
Oh, it's a magnificent tree.
It's a wonderful tree.
Yeah, it's just royal. It's just, and when the, it's even more beautiful when the leaves fall.
Yeah.
Because the sun sort of dapples the limbs and the trunk. And no, it's a magnificent tree.
I knew that was going to be the tree when you wrote that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I knew it. I want to just talk a little bit, how did this book come into being? Why did you write these essays? When did you start writing them, and why did you start writing them? And poems, I should say, essays and poems.
Short essays as commentaries for public radio.
Right.
And so I've gotten accustomed to writing short observations and experiences, and I just wrote them one by one, not with a book in mind. And then the challenge was to make it a book. But when I experience something unusual or observe something unusual, I often write it down.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just sort of expanded. And the poetry, I've been writing seriously poetry for probably for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Some of them go back a little earlier. I wrote about my late husband, both the joy of that relationship and how wonderful it was, and then his slow decline, which was difficult. And I also thought that a lot of women my age may have gone through similar experiences. You're especially aware of that at Wake Robin, where there are a lot of widows who came here as a couple and have lost their husbands. So it just developed.
Yes. Yeah. I thought it was a wonderful. I loved reading about your relationship with John. How old were you when you got together?
I was 72.
72. And he was 9 years older.
Yeah, eight and a half, to
eight
be
and
precise.
A half. Okay. No, it was wonderful. There was this great sense of good fortune in all of your recollections of your time with him.
Yes.
Did he read some of this book?
Yes, he read all of it.
All of it.
Except maybe some of the later edits.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, he was my first reader.
Yeah, I think you said that in your acknowledgments. Mm-hmm. One of the parts that I thought a lot of people could relate to, you write about, first of all, about moving out of your previous home and having to get rid of things, and then you write about redecorating this cottage that we are sitting in, and I'm pleased to see it because I feel like I know it. And you write about buying chairs that were a little outside of the character of what you might have done before, the red chairs. So do you want to talk a little bit about that period of time?
Well, I think most everybody except those who are able to age in place has the experience of leaving one home for another or for a retirement home. And downsizing sounds fine, sounds like even be fun to get rid of things. And in a way, it is, but in another way, it's painful because your home is the accumulation of all the things you've gathered through a lifetime. And each thing that you cast off is like casting off a chapter of your life or memory. And at the same time, you say, this is good for me. This will be easier. I will have a simpler life. But the process is hard.
Mm-hmm.
The best part is the fact when I could give things to my children, then you feel there's some continuity. But books, for example, I've gotten rid of books at least two or three times in my life, but I love books. And again, they reflect chapters of my life. So I finally ended up just keeping some, regardless of what they were. I just wanted a wall of books here at Wake Robin. And then when I was ambassador in Switzerland, I wanted some of my books to make me feel at home and to get rid of the musty leather-bound books that had been there in some official capacity in my residence in Bern, Switzerland, when I was the American ambassador to Switzerland. So it's difficult, but it must be done, and it's better that we do it while we're alive.
Yes, yeah.
And so others can enjoy them and have pleasure.
As a big reader and someone who loves books, I enjoyed reading about which books you chose to have sent to Switzerland, which ones you chose to put on your shelves, because you also wanted them to say something about your character to the people
right.
who came to visit you there. Right. That was really fun to read about. And it made me wonder, like, what books would I choose if I wanted them to speak to my character? It's hard to say because there's so many.
Right, yeah. Right.
All right. So there is a point in the book where your husband, John, did begin to decline. It sounds like it actually started before you moved here.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. And one of the outcomes was that he suffered from depression. And you write, he was inside his depression and I was left outside. I could not reach in to pull him out. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about that, and if you can talk about surviving a loved one's depression for other people who maybe live with someone who suffers from that. It must be very difficult.
It is difficult, because if you love someone and you live with them as your husband or your partner, you want to rescue them, and you think you should be able to. And I'm sure in some cases that is possible, but it was very hard between the two of us, even though there were respites. There were, you know, there were times when we could be on the same wavelength in the same place at the same time. But depression is very, very difficult. And he tried all kinds of medication, and at times he would cheer up. He would come back to his old self. But it's a struggle. And you feel so much for the pain that the depressed person is going through. So in a way, it almost makes you depressed, but not in the same way.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that happens when we are healthy emotionally is that we can interact with each other and help each other. Mm-hmm. And I think when someone is depressed, they're more isolated and unable to kind of alleviate what you might be going through in...
Right. Yeah. Right. It is isolating, but you know, there are remedies that work well for some people. It just didn't happen to work well for John, though he had remissions when things were easier.
Before you met John, this was one of my favorite quotes in the book. This is just a little thing, but I loved it. You said, some years, so you had a first marriage and you were divorced, and you said, some years after my divorce, I had begun to peruse dating sites. I knew that they produced many wonderful romances, but I dared not enter my name for fear I would be discovered. Former Vermont governor, late 60s, looking for... That was great. I don't think I have a question. I just loved that. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about your time in politics. And one thing that you write about in this book is being a woman, being a female politician, the uniform of the female politician. You were very, I thought, very empathetic thinking about Hillary Clinton. I think you said she was imprisoned in her black pantsuit. You write that you're not allowed to be too feminine and you're not allowed to be too masculine, and it's hard to find a uniform. So is that still the case for women who are in politics, do you think? Probably.
I think it's changing, as everything is changing today. I mean, more women are running, as you know, than ever before, and they have more diverse resumes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have to work your way up through the system. A lot of men don't work their way up from, you know, city council to legislator to governor or senator. So you don't have to march up those steps. But having said that, I have to add, there's still some expectation that you dress in a way that people are comfortable with. You know, there was this book in the 70s called Dress for Success.
Right.
And that was not only in politics, but in business, wherever female leaders were aspiring to. And it was the navy blue suit and the white blouse, but it had a little frill around the neck to show that you were feminine enough. And not stilettos, of course. I can't imagine campaigning in stilettos anyway. But I think there's more freedom now. But you still have to present an image,
right,
that people can relate to. I mean, it's still a jump for people to say, well, here's a woman running for president or for governor. When you say the word president or say the word governor, always a male image comes to your mind. So I think you can do different things, but you have to be comfortable in your own clothes, and you have to be comfortable in yourself as a woman. And I think more women are doing that. And it's just terribly exciting to see so many women running for office. I mean, I've promoted female candidates ever since I was elected, and I've lectured about it and talked about it. So suddenly this wave has come upon us, and I guess it's not a mystery why so many women are jumping in. I think they're inspired by Donald Trump and just saying, I'm not going to sit home and complain. I'm going to get in the action and
do something.
And women before were always stopped by saying, I'm not qualified. Somehow they've jumped through that hoop.
Well, now everybody's clearly qualified.
almost everybody. And that's why I started an organization in Vermont called Emerge.
I wanted to ask you about Emerge Vermont. Is that
yes.
what it's called?
Yeah. And we train and recruit Democratic women to run for office. And it's also, Vermont's part of the national organization. We were the 14th state to join Emerge, and that was 5 years ago. And a lot of women have gone through the program. Many have run for office, and quite a few have gotten elected. And you might ask, well, there's no Emerge for men. Why do women still need this extra boost? And it's mostly a question of confidence. Mm-hmm. There's no course you can take running for office, but there is this program, and it's still sort of a mystery what talents you need to run. And so we're very practical. We don't raise money for campaigns like Emily's List. We just give people the skills, such as having a stump speech, and we videotape the stump speech, and then everybody can be a critic, and everybody can improve their speaking. Raising money, which is a hard thing for many people, and women actually practice raising money by calling real people and getting over the hesitation. So it's very useful. And sort of an interesting side effect is that the women in the program bond, and they suddenly become supportive of one another. So if somebody decides to run, she's got a network of Emerge people who will stand by her side and give her courage. I mean, it's still a risk to run for office, and the whole process has become nastier and more scary in some ways today. But in Vermont, I think we're still somewhat better off that we haven't had the kind of dirty fake news politics, at least not that we are aware of. And women can run for local office. We don't look very good, frankly, when you're looking at a percentage of women in local office in Vermont. It's about 20% female. And some places have never elected a woman for local government. Mm-hmm. So you can start where you're comfortable. But sometimes I say in speeches, I amend that statement and say, start where you're not comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there was, I think, a representative running in Bennington who just withdrew her candidacy. Is that correct? Because
yes.
She was threatened.
It's very sad.
That's very sad.
Very outrageous, really. She went through the program, and she's been a wonderful legislator, and it just got too much for her to be harassed. And, it also shows that women still struggle with certain family issues, and she's got a long commute from Bennington to Montpelier, the capital, so all this weight on her. But I'm glad the Attorney General is finally looking into it. It's a sad reflection on Vermont to recognize that contributed to her stepping down.
Right, yeah. Well, let's talk about your having become a politician. You used to work, as I said, for the Burlington Free Press, and you, well, let's back up. Your early life, you were born in Switzerland, and you had a lot happen at a very early age. You lost your father. He took his own life. He had PTSD, I think you write
in the
book.
That's what I concluded.
Yeah, yeah. Your family fled Hitler. So I wonder if you can look at your early life and talk a little bit about what you think influenced your path to politics and public service, and if those early experiences were part of that.
Well, it's hard to trace
yeah.
decisions like this.
I'm
I mean,
sure.
obviously, a lot of things influenced me, but I think I finally reached the conclusion after some reflection that being an immigrant in the United States from Switzerland in a way gave me hope. I mean, my mother was very proud to be in America, and she used to say to both me and my brother, anything is possible in America. So I think we believed that.
Yeah.
We lived by that. So we felt we could aspire to anything. And I didn't start out ever thinking I would be governor. That was not, or even a legislator, I didn't think about that. I did think about that I would probably like to marry a politician. Little did I know how hard that was. But you know, Gloria Steinem said, you know, we have become the men we thought we would marry. And that's true. And I sort of went into it carefully, you know, first running for the legislature and then discovering I really enjoyed it and that I was pretty good at it, that I could survive in this world.
Yeah. It sounded to me from reading your book that you always had supportive partners
yes.
when it came to your professional career.
Yes, my first husband was supportive. He campaigned. He took on more of the family responsibilities. And John, my second husband, was an ardent feminist and a Democrat, which is unusual for a man who's been dean of the Tuck School of Business.
Mm.
Most of the business school folks are Republican, as you might expect. But yes, I was very fortunate because it's almost impossible to do this if your spouse or partner is not supportive.
Right, right. I think especially for women.
Yeah, well, also for men. I mean,
right.
It's especially for women, but also for men. And if not a partner, you know, a best friend or a team of friends. I also had a group of friends who I had lunch with every once in a while who were not political, but who were just good friends, and I needed that.
Yeah. So at what point did you approach Greenwriters Press about publishing this book or about collecting your essays and poems?
After I finished the book, and I made inquiries at some other places, but I actually came across the publishing house, and you know, it's a small publishing house, fairly new, but the beauty of it is they're so enthusiastic.
Yeah.
So they really gave me courage and incentive to keep going. And I have a very good agent. So it just worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I don't know is how popular this book is, which you never know until the returns come in. It's like an election. And we'll see. But from the few readings I've done of the poetry, I'm surprised and thrilled with the response.
Yeah, yeah. My prediction is that it will be very well received, partly because it's different for you. Mm. You know, it's like what we were saying earlier, you know, it's a more personal story
yeah.
than what you've written before.
Right. And so I think at this point, as I'm awaiting its publication, I sometimes tell myself, that's somebody else who wrote that book. As I try to brace myself for the personal exposure.
Yeah. So this is an aside, but one of your essays talks about your height, and you said that you were always, I mean, this is not a quote, but you were so grateful to Mira Wigdor for being taller than you. I would just like to say that I am Mira Wigdor, and you are welcome.
Is it Mira or Myra?
I don't know.
It's Myra.
Myra. Oh, okay. I'm just saying it wrong. But I was always the tallest in any class.
Of, yeah.
Yeah. Always. So I understand Myra's predicament.
Yeah. I wonder when they stopped lining up children according to size.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, who reads your work before you go to press? John was your first reader.
Yeah.
Who else reads your work?
Well, there's a woman here who I mentioned in the acknowledgement, Lolly Cobb, mm-hmm. and she was very helpful. And then I sent it to Liz Bankowski, and she was my campaign manager, my chief of staff, and we've had a lot of discussions about aging and women, and so it just I valued her feedback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things that is dealt with in the book, and it makes sense, is losing people. You know, you write of missing the father you didn't really know very well. You write of missing your brother who passed away, your husband now, John. Can we talk a little bit about that aspect of aging? And, you know, everybody wants to live a long, healthy life, but it's hard, you know, even if you do, because you have to go through all of that. And you also have a wonderful chapter about what it's like living in a place with other people who are elderly, and you have to cope with death even more on a sort of regular basis in that environment.
Yeah, I mean, the older you get, the closer death becomes. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're young, you don't think that much about it. At least most people don't, because you think you'll live forever. But you don't want to dwell on it. You know, it's a contradiction in a way. You have to think about it to cope with it, but at the same time, you want to use as much of your energy as you can and exercise and eat well, and all those things that are supposed to prolong life or make life more joyful. So, especially at a retirement community like this is, you just see it more often. You see people in wheelchairs and in walkers. So you sort of know what's in store for you down the road. I both sort of rebel against that and yet suspect I'm going to end up there too. I had an interesting experience the other day. I was talking to a woman who's very, very thin, almost skeleton. And she had an oxygen mask and was carrying a case that contained the oxygen, and she was on the bus going to a concert on the Wake Robin bus.
Okay.
And we started a conversation, and I thought she might be whispering her response. She looked so frail. Well, we had a wonderful conversation about the composer, the program. Her voice was strong, and it was another lesson to me that we shouldn't judge by exteriors or by appearances, because she was totally alive and totally alert. And it was a pleasure to have this conversation. So sometimes we assume old people are out of it when they're really not, when they have a lot to say, especially if you ask them and they're interested. They're interested that somebody's interested in them.
Yeah, right. It reminds me actually of the conversation we had a little bit ago about attire. You know, we can also make the assumption that somebody is qualified because they are dressed a certain way.
Mm.
They might not be, you know, they might not. I mean, just to make assumptions based on looks and based on presentation is a mistake.
Right.
Well, that brings us to Donald Trump.
Oh.
What are your predictions?
I'm afraid to make predictions because he's defied most of them. But I think he's a very dangerous man. And I think the country is in peril because of his leadership. You know, everything from the Justice Department to censorship, when he keeps damning the press and calling it fake press and a threat to the country and a lie to the American people. I mean, a free press is the fundamental centerpiece of a democracy. You may not always agree with them. I certainly didn't, when I was governor, always agree with them. But I never tried to censor or withhold. And sometimes they made me a better governor when they brought something to my attention. So I think that's the greatest threat. And then there are things like fighting against climate change and against regulations that are intended to reduce poisonous emissions that can really do harm, especially to children. So it's from soup to nuts that he's pushing back, as if he had a chart on his wall of everything Obama did and is checking it off one by one. So question is, can our Constitution and our political system control him or boot him out? I think it'd be very hard to impeach him, but a lot hangs on the midterm elections now. No, he could either, if we do get the House, which is more likely than the Senate, I don't know what his reaction will be. He may call them faked or rigged elections, for all I know. But I think at least it will be a break that may hold him in check for a minute or two. But I think this is a perilous time in our country.
Thank you for addressing that. All right, we'll go to something lighter. What are you reading now or lately that you might have enjoyed?
Well, I just happen to be reading Rachel Cusk, okay. C-U-S-K,
yes.
who I like. I belong to a book group. We read a lot of different things. The Gentleman from Moscow.
Oh, right. That was a wonderful book.
Yeah, that's my most recent
book. That's a wonderful book. Okay. The other one that he wrote is really good. Hmm. I liked it almost as much.
Oh, really?
Which surprised me, because I loved A Gentleman from Moscow. The Rules of Civility, that's his other book.
Oh, really?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And then, you know, I mentioned Anita Buchner.
Oh, yes, you do. And I looked her up, and she has 24 novels.
Really?
And I haven't read her yet, so I'm looking forward to
similar,
that.
But they're, I don't know, just relate to her.
Yeah. Okay, so what are you writing now?
I didn't write after John's death for quite a while.
When did he die?
January 11th this year.
Okay.
And I finally got back to writing poetry, so that's what I'm focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's like a muscle. You have to use it. You have to exercise it. And as a writer, you may know, but every time you write something and you're pleased with it, and then you think, I can never do that again. So I'm in that stage where I'm not sure what I'm producing now is as good as what I thought I had written before. So it's a delicate thing, writing.
Yeah. Well, my last question for you has to do with writing. I know that you've always been a writer, but writing poetry is somewhat new for you. And I just wonder if you have advice for people who are just starting to write in advanced years.
In advanced years. Well, I think it's never too late to become a writer. I think you have to have some quiet time and a place to write and a time to write, and just say, I'm going to sit down. And then something does happen. Probably the best advice I ever got was when I was at Dartmouth after my governorship, and a woman told me, all writing is rewriting. And sometimes the hardest part is putting those first words down. And this crow sits on your shoulder and says, no good, no good, No good. And you just have to shoo that ugly bird away and keep going. And then you can always change it. I mean, that's what people forget. It really does change with rewriting. And most of the time for the better. So don't be your worst critic. Be nice to yourself and write something down. And like you're having a conversation, that's the best way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful advice. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Good. Well, thank you.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with former Vermont Governor Madeline Cunin about her new memoir, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. You can learn more about her work at her publisher's website, greenwriterspress.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a transition from one era to another in your own life, as Madeline May Cunin has written about her journey to the 80s. Are you a new teenager? A new parent? Have you recently gone through menopause? Have you retired? We are all constantly aging and going through transitions, but how often do we write about these changes in our lives, minds, and bodies? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.